On this week's 51%, a reform advocate in New York retires from her post.
You can go down the decades of very, very well educated and community-minded women who found the League as a place where they could help their communities. And I was still part of that generation.
We hear about empowering girls through dance, and we meet a female playwright whose work is about children in military families. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
If you wanna do right.
Close of the New York State legislative session at the end of June, a familiar face and voice is bidding farewell to the Capitol. 51%'s Dave Lucas spoke with Barbara Bartoletti, a longtime advocate for reform in Albany, who is retiring from her post as legislative director for the New York State League of Women Voters, a nonpartisan political organization.
You've been called an engineer of socio-political change. You've been a voice when it comes to ethics reform in New York State.
Yes, but something that people would easily recognize in their everyday life that the League thinks has been one of our biggest accomplishments, and it was in collaboration with my colleague Blair Horner, who actually probably was primarily responsible for our being able to do this. Even in the young days of technology, his use of the ability to find things out was the Clean Indoor Air Act, which changed the behavior in New York, and I think we were a leader. In fact, we were probably the leader, maybe California, but we were probably the East Coast leader of making sure that people could go into a restaurant, a bar, have their children on the playground, libraries, etc., where there was no smoking. And I think that is one of the most clearly seen and one of the things that personally I and the League consider one of our biggest accomplishments in the span of the last, 25 years or so. And now you really have to look hard to find people who are smoking still, maybe outside of some buildings, but we have become a smoke-free state, a smoke-free society, and I think that was one of my biggest accomplishments, was being part of passing that Clean Indoor Air Act.
You've been with the League of Women Voters for 40 years through six governors. What's your most memorable moment?
There's more than one, actually, Dave. I remember the day we were in the throes in the late 80s and 90s of the reproductive choice, and abortion was a huge issue in the Capitol, and I remember being at one committee meeting, and they don't hold them in 7-Eleven anymore, but they used to, and because so many people wanted to attend the Health Committee, and Saul Weprin was then the speaker, and he made an appearance in that committee. I can still see it today, walk behind every single member's chair, and that was the signal by this, speakers have always been quite powerful, as you know. That was his signal to his members on the Democratic side, and of course there were more Democrats than Republicans in the committee, that you vote the way I want you to vote or else. And indeed they did. And then there, of course, was the moment with Governor Spitzer, that fateful day on a Monday. He was supposed to show up at an FPA convention in the convention hall, and he didn't show up, and I walked Shelley Silver down because he was going to speak, and I said to Shelley, gee, you know what happened to the governor? And he said, oh, that was on Monday morning, and he said, oh, I think he's just not feeling well. And about 4 hours later, we found out, of course, why he probably wasn't feeling well. And I remember running back up to the Capitol and having the Capitol feel like a funeral parlor. I mean, people were crying. It was just dead silent. people were really in shock. And then, of course, it became a circus. I mean, every media and every satellite truck that you can possibly imagine, both from all over the state, all over the nation, I mean, people were flooding into Albany because, you know, this was a governor accused of being part of a prostitution ring. And then, of course, there was the coup, the famous Bragman Silver coup, where we sat in the galleries in the assembly chamber for 2.5 hours while Michael Bragman went through every bit of the Democrats' dirty laundry before, of course, he was ostracized to the furthest off office in the LOB on South Swan Street, where his poor receptionist had to wear a parka every day. And then, of course, he left the assembly. Those are some of the very memorable moments of this very long tenure.
And with this very long tenure coming to an end,
I do have a young woman who has been with me for 2 sessions now. She is ready to go. It is time to do that, passing the torch to the new generation.
Jennifer Wilson will be taking Bartoletti's place. Wilson recently worked as an aide to Senator Charles Schumer.
She is ready to do the job, and I have told her, because she said to me a couple of times, oh, what am I going to do without you? And I have said a couple of times, Jen, I'm a phone call away. You got a question? Call me. If you need help one afternoon, if I'm not out skiing or doing something else, just give me a call and I'll come down and, you know, buttonhole a few people.
Your position is entirely volunteer, right?
Mine is yes. Jennifer's will not. We have also passed that torch because, of course, as you probably know, Dave, back when I started working with the League was filled with women who were well educated but did not yet have to be in the workplace, because there wasn't an awful lot of things women did in those days. If you were not a nurse, a teacher, a social worker, or a school teacher, a nurse, teacher, social worker, and executive secretary, that's kind of what you could do. Now women gleefully, I am so thrilled that the League was part of that movement. Now, well-educated women are in the workplace. So as those of us who were fortunate enough to have gainfully employed spouses, we needed an outlet for our energies, and the community seemed to be the place to do it. And so many of the women, even in the early League, people like Eleanor Roosevelt, she was a leader in the state league until, of course, her husband became governor. And you can go down the decades of very, very well educated and community-minded women who found the League as a place where they could help their communities. And I was still part of that generation. Today, young women like Jennifer, they are in the workplace, and, of course, they expect to be paid. And that's not a bad thing.
When you first came in to the League, What was the biggest issue of concern? And now, fast forward 4 decades, what do you think is the biggest concern as you make your exit?
Okay, that's relatively an easy question, thank you. That when I came into the League, it was all about women going back into the workforce, and it was about daycare, or childcare, I guess, as we call it now. It was making childcare more accessible to those women who had children but also felt, either through their educational background or because they needed that second income in families, and it became much more that than it did the former. And so people needed childcare. And so the League, when I first came into the League, that was a huge issue with the League, was how do we get the state to have childcare more available, whether it was in the workplace or making sure that we had the subsidies that would allow people not to have their income so drained when they really did need to be in the workforce. So that was the issue that I came in on. And now, of course, a lot of what the League has is a multi-issue organization, and we have a full complement of issues that I have worked on, but certainly the most prominent issues today are, you know, government reform, but also protecting the environment, protecting a woman's right to choice, and protecting public education. I mean, those are the issues that I will go out feeling as if there's still more work to be done.
That was outgoing New York State League of Women Voters Legislative Director Barbara Bartoletti speaking with 51%'s Dave Lucas. During the interview, Bartoletti mentioned Blair Horner. He's executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group. The League of Women Voters operates at the local, state, and national levels, and they are in every state, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. There was a dance performance recently that showcased the work of young students from a private dance center in Ulster County, New York. This year's performance included a focus on empowering girls, a theme that grew out of, in part, the presidential election. I spoke with founder and director of Barefoot Dance Center, Jesse Levy, about the annual performance. Levy says one of the pieces on the program, Like a Girl, explores sexism that girls encounter in their daily lives. She says it grew out of a project a few years ago called The Importance of Taking Up Space. It examined how teenage girls feel about being girls. Fast forward to November 2016, when Donald Trump was elected president.
Sexploitation of girls in dance education has gotten worse and worse and worse progressively over the years. And then, of course, with Trump becoming president and all of my students having heard what he said about women and see how he treats women, it was so shocking to them that somebody like that could actually become our president. So the day after the election, these girls came to dance class. They weren't allowed to speak about the election at many of the schools because teachers and administrators didn't want kids to get into fights, I guess. And so they kind of exploded into the dance studio with all of these deep, deep feelings. And so we just sat in a circle, and I just said, everybody's going to get a chance to talk, and everybody's going to get a chance to listen. And then they started working on pieces. And we actually turned this dance into something very specifically about all sorts of different concerns that they had.
And here's how some of those concerns arose and the dance piece evolved.
They did this beautiful, amazing work based on a list that they created called The Pros and Cons of Being a Girl. And the cons list, side of the list, was almost twice as long as the pros. And these girls were like 9 to 12, so it was really sad. But I do think that as they worked harder and harder on this project, they felt more and more empowered by it, and they felt more able to stand up for themselves and talk about their perceptions of experiences that they had, and also what they're seeing in the world around them. And one of my favorite quotes by one of the students, they went around in the circle, and I said, okay, what are some pros and what are some cons? And one girl raised her hand, and I said, okay, what is it? She said, it's definitely a con. And I said, well, what is it? And she said, the need to prove that we're not damsels in distress, which I thought was amazing. And that kind of became a jumping-off point for us and the choreography project that they worked on, which they ended up calling Like a Girl.
Levy gives an example of how girls are becoming empowered through dance.
This really funny story of a mom telling me that, you know, they were in the store the other day, and there was a guy in the store who was kind of behaving not very nicely, and her daughter looked at her and said, Mom, let's get out of here. He is a sexist pig. You know, and so they're starting to recognize, you know, when behavior is positive toward girls or negative. And I think she felt that way because, you know, this person was making comments about bodies. And we just don't do that here. So she had an understanding, and she had the confidence to say, I don't want to listen to that. I don't want to be around that.
Levy believes there is a pervasive hypersexualization of female dance students in general, another reason why her curriculum uses dance as a platform for empowering girls.
It's quite a phenomenon. You know, in many, many dance schools, it's become kind of the norm for adults to choreograph movements that are adult movements, and the dance is to, you know, a song where the lyrics are also based on very mature themes. And then the kids are asked to wear very sexualized costumes and doing perhaps movements that they don't even know themselves to be sexual because they're too young to understand that. And my feeling is this is one of the dangers of choreographing, taking our adult themes and ideas and concepts and placing them on children. I think as a choreographer, I'm much more interested in listening to the kids and hearing where they're at and either letting them express themselves by choreographing on their own, or if I'm going to choreograph on them, make sure that I stay in their world. And it's not to dumb them down, because they're not dumb. They're incredibly smart and incredibly creative. So I can give voice to them in a sophisticated way, but at an age-appropriate way.
That was Jessie Levy, director of Barefoot Dance Center in Ulster County, New York, speaking about empowering girls through dance. A West Coast group is using youth theater to tell the stories of an often forgotten group of children. They're the kids who grow up in military families, who are accustomed to moving frequently and having their parents leave for long deployments. Hannah Harris Green reports.
At the La Jolla Playhouse, just north of San Diego, veteran and performer Kendrick Dial is showing a group of actors how to perform basic military rituals.
And then for a salute, it's just right hand up.
It's part of a script workshop for a play about military families. Children around San Diego and Hawaii will see the play, which is a joint production of the Pop Tour in San Diego County and the Honolulu Theater for Youth.
At ease is just typically you're going to step out. You always step out with your left foot.
People like Dial, with real connections to the military, are shaping the script, both in and out of the rehearsal room. Before today's script workshop with veterans and military children, the creative team toured military bases to learn about family life there.
Now, this is one of the first projects that I've ever worked on as a writer where journalism and playwriting kind of come together.
That's the playwright, Lee Cataluna. She also works as a journalist in Honolulu.
I'm meeting people, asking questions, hearing their stories, and then writing a play about it. So kind of my worlds are colliding in this project.
Cataluna has been conducting a lot of those interviews in military schools. Military children don't get the same level of literary attention soldiers do. Gathering material for the play, Cataluna has found a wealth of untold stories.
One daughter remembered it was her birthday when Dad had to be deployed. And her birthday party was a cupcake in the back of the car after they drove to the airport to say goodbye.
Every military child story is different. But there is one question that comes up again and again. Cataluna wrote about it in an early draft the actors read aloud during the script workshop.
The new kid walked in and the teacher said, "Say hello to our new student. Tell us, where are you from?"
And all of us who know were like,
where are you from? It's a hard question to answer if you grew up moving from military base to military base.
I'm from everywhere.
I'm from right here, right now.
Military brats of all ages came to workshop the script. They all could agree on how it feels when they're asked where they're from. But the younger generation of military children also had a lot to say about technology like FaceTime. Dylan, a grade school age kid, talked about FaceTiming with his dad on his birthday.
He was in Okinawa, and we were FaceTiming, and my sister was in the living room, and she wouldn't come out because she knew she was going to cry, and all my friends were there and stuff. So I don't really like FaceTime, but sometimes I do.
Eric Johnson, the director of the play, says these are exactly the kinds of experiences civilians should learn to understand.
Rarely do we hear the stories of the young people who are also sacrificing and are also in service of their country. I mean, they're giving up a parent for deployment. They're moving to place as their parent moves from a post to post. And I would say even I, you know, didn't fully understand it till I started working on this project.
Children from civilian and military families will watch this play. The people working hard at the La Jolla Playhouse to create the script hope all those kids will understand military family life much sooner and much better. I'm Hannah Harris Green in La Jolla, California.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Now we bring you a love story. It's a story about immigrants, separation, and adjustment. Locals sometimes worry how newcomers will adjust to life in America, but for immigrants, their hearts and voices often reach out across the ocean to family left behind. KFAI's Emily Bright reports on a couple separated by war and reunited.
When an ocean separated Sosten and Inzaghire, they sang to each other on the phone. Inzaghire was in the Congo. Sosten was here in Minnesota. Sosten and Inzaghire were married with six children. and they were still very much in love. Singing was their way to stay connected. When immigrants arrive in the U.S., locals might worry about how they'll adapt to their new home. But what the locals don't understand is what the newcomers have left behind.
I never think that I will move my country. I love my country so much.
That's why 17 years ago, he started a nonprofit dedicated to helping child soldiers rejoin society in the war-torn Democratic Republic of Congo. More than 5 million people have died in a raging conflict that some have described as Africa's World War. Because of his work, Sosten's life was threatened. When he was in the U.S. for a 2013 conference, his wife told him it wasn't safe to return to the Congo.
We said, no, you can't come home. He said, I cannot just leave my work like that. I came here. We fought arranging a place to stay. I have to come back.
No. Sosten didn't want to believe what his wife was telling him. He kept hoping things would get better and he could return home soon. In the meantime, all they had was the phone.
Every day he'd call, at least 2-3 times a day. Sometime I would say, when do you ever sleep? And he'd say, I can't sleep without hearing your voice and the kids' voices. The two older girls were in Nairobi in Kenya. He'd call us, then he'd call the older girls every day. That gave me strength, but it was so, so hard.
Yeah.
You can laugh on the phone. You can cry. You can sing. Ask, how was your day? It was the only way we had to stay connected.
The lyrics say, even though mothers might leave their children in the chaos of war, God will never leave you. Six months passed. The polar vortex of 2013 set in. Sosten shivered through it and tried to adapt to his new surroundings. He had a strong case to seek asylum in the U.S. because he would get killed if he went home. Finally, he got a lawyer and applied to stay.
Our family didn't know when we'd be able to see him again. But as time passed and things didn't get better, he had to apply for asylum. Things were really unstable for us that whole time.
They waited. They called. They sang.
Gloire à Dieu, gloire à Dieu, terre écoute sa voix.
It took a year for the U.S. government to decide he could stay. But what about his family? He filed paperwork. Another year passed. More than 2.5 years after Inzaghire called to say, don't come home, her husband called with good news. She and the kids could come to the U.S. The family is reunited, but daily life in Minnesota has huge challenges. There's a new language, new culture, new schools for the kids. There's still fear. So Sosten and Inzaghire are not using their real names in this story. The singing that privately sustained them has slowly gone public. Sosten, Inzaghire, and the 6 children now perform at Twin Cities churches. Unlike the tens of thousands of Somalis and Liberians in the Twin Cities, there are only a few hundred French-speaking Congolese. They miss having a community.
I continue to wish one day I will be back in my country.
For KFAI, I'm Emily Bright.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. The show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1456.